This too is part of our original constitution, and is so essential and active a principle that the absence of it, always taken as a decisive indication of confirmed profligacy, insomuch that there is hardly a more striking epitome of a thoroughly depraved character than that he is without shame. Though some higher principle than a regard to the opinion of the world is necessary to constitute an action good in the sight of God, or to be the foundation of a religious life, and though this principle, like every other, is liable to abuse and needs to be properly restrained and regulated, still, no doubt it was intended by Providence to impose a check upon our vicious inclination, and so essential is its operations to the welfare and, I may say, the existence of society, that if all those evil propensities which are now kept in check by a regard to the opinion of the world were allowed to operate freely, it is probable that all the opposition which human laws could make to the vices of men would be no more than the weakest mound of earth set to defy the angry torrent as it comes rushing from the mountains. If then this principle be so important to the preservation of virtue in the community, and of course to the virtue of each individual, surely anything which has a tendency to extinguish it is greatly to be deprecated. And that this is the direct tendency of evil company must be obvious to every one. Here again I appeal directly to the consciences of those, if there be any such before me, whose experience renders them the most competent judges. When you first associated with those who took the name of God in vain, would not the thought of your ever being heard to utter the same language have crimsoned your cheek with shame? But after a while, did this not peculiar sensibility to the opinion of the world so far wear off that when none but your sinful companions were present, you ventured a profane expression, and even after you could swear fearlessly in their presence, was it not a considerable time before you could feel willing to hazard an oath in the hearing of your serious friends? And when after taking the name of God in vain, you have sometimes turned your face and been unexpectedly met by the reproving countenance of some pious friend, have you not been awed into confusion by the majesty of virtue, and felt that you have done an act which in the estimation of that good man would cover you with disgrace? But you may, for aught I know, have long since bid adieu to all such scruples, and you may be congratulating yourself upon the victory you have gained over a prejudice of education, and you may have become so shockingly familiar with the dialect of hell that even the presence of the virtuous and good cannot restrain you from it. For all this may be calculated upon as a legitimate consequence of being often found in the way of sinners. Just so it is with the sin of intemperance. Probably the greatest drunkard in the community can remember the time when he would have shuddered at the thought of thus foolishly sacrificing his reputation. And perhaps there was hardly ever an instance in which a man yielded to this kind of temptation for the first time that he was not thoroughly ashamed of it, and would turn his face from you when you met him in the street, lest your countenance should reveal to him your pity or contempt. But by frequently resorting to the company of drunkards, and by repeating a few times a brutish experiment, the flush of shame faded from his cheek and made way for a still deeper hue of crimson, which proclaims that he is a shameless sot. And so it is with respect to every other bad habit. By frequenting the society of the vicious, a person soon comes practically to regard them as the most important part of the world, and consequently his regard for the opinion of the good and his fear of losing it are gradually diminished and destroyed. Number 4. Another sentiment which is brought into operation in aid of the vicious habit by associating with wicked companions is a dread of being singular. There is nothing that goes to the heart of a young man like the world's dread laugh, or the idea of standing alone, or of being charged with superstitious scruples of conscience. This is a principle of which the abaters of vice are always sure to avail themselves in regard to those who are inexperienced. When a young man whose mind has been stored with good sentiments through the influence of education falls into their company, it is wonderful to observe how their invention is quickened for devising means for his destruction. They take care not to display to him all the mysteries of iniquity at once, lest it produce a shock which should drive him from their society. At first, perhaps, he discovers in them nothing more than an excessive cheerfulness, and so far he thinks they may be imitated without much danger. But it is not long before he must take another step, and if he hesitates and falters now, he sees on one side a reproachful frown, and on the other a contemptuous smile. One perhaps charges him with unmanly superstition, and another with the want of independence, or, it may be, the whole fraternity of them set up one general shout of ridicule. At such a moment I look upon a young man as suspended between life and death, and as the experiment which is now going forward may result, I expect his eternal destiny will be decided. If I could look into his heart at this awful crisis, I should expect to find it in a state of fearful agitation. And if the power of reflection had not deserted him, to find him proposing to himself some such questions as these: what step is this which I am now tempted to take? Whither will it conduct me? May it not ruin my character and ruin my soul? What mean these counsels and warnings of my early youth that now come knocking at the door of my heart? If I yield, will not the hearts of my pious friends bleed with tenfold deeper sorrow than if I were to die? Nay, will it not almost send a pang of agony down into the graves of my departed parents, who dedicated me to God and with their dying breath charged me to beware of a life of sin? But how can I sustain the anguish of being singular? How can I bear to be thought mean and spiritless, to hear these shouts of ridicule and witness these expressions of contempt? No, I will not submit to this intolerable burden. I will rush headlong into the haunts of sin and endeavor to stifle conscience and drown reflection. Cease then to trouble me, ye recollections of my early days, ye pious friends who have followed me all my life with affectionate wishes and good offices. I can heed you no longer. I will sooner pierce all your hearts with anguish than to stand alone and try to stem this torrent of ridicule. And you too, departed parents, even if I knew I should disturb the repose of your graves and plant a thorn in that pillow which sustains your head in yonder lonely mansion, I could not bear to be a singular. Leave me, therefore, friends, leave me, conscience, leave me every tender and enduring recollection, leave me too, ye gloomy forebodings of future misery, and let me sacrifice myself as quickly as I can. I can hazard anything else, even the eternal burnings of hell, but I will not hazard the odium of being singular. I do believe, my hearers, that many a young man who now sits in the seat of the scoffer, if he would honestly tell you his whole experience, would be obliged to relate the story of some such conflict as this, which I have here supposed. And it may be that there are young persons before me who can recollect something like it in their own experience. But if I knew there were such a case, I should hardly think it premature to call upon you to begin even now to mourn for the death of an immortal soul. Number 5. I shall close the illustration of this subject with one more remark. And that is that it is a tendency of evil company to separate a person from the means of grace. What though he may live in the midst of Christian privileges, and almost at the very threshold of the sanctuary, will he, think you, enter those hallowed courts where everything betokens reverence and purity when his heart loathes the service of his Maker? Will he deliberately place himself in the way of reproof for those very vices to which he has deliberately resolved to yield? Will he be likely to read the Word of God when he meets his own sentence of condemnation on every page? I do not say indeed that the whole extent of this evil will ordinarily be realized in the early stages of vice. On the contrary, I well know that its progress for the most part is gradual, but I do say, and I appeal to the heart of every profligate for the truth of it, that the tendency of vicious company is finally to form a complete separation from all the means of religion. If he be entirely devoted to the service of sin, it were an absurdity to suppose that he should have either time or relish for the service of God. And even if he attend upon it with external formality for a while, it will soon become too irksome to be continued. And when the means of grace are once abandoned, I know not where we are to look for a more decisive symptom of a hard heart and a reprobate mind. We must not indeed venture to limit the power of the Most High. But if there ever be a case which upon all the principles of human probability we may pronounce hopeless, and in which our most awful apprehensions may reasonably cluster around the destiny of a fallen mortal, surely it is the case of him who has voluntarily cut himself off from the means of salvation. On a review of this subject, number one, we may see how insidious is vice. From small and almost imperceptible beginnings, it gradually makes its way till it reduces the whole man to its dominion and brings into captivity every affection and faculty of the soul. It first throws out the bait of pleasure and flatters its victim onto forbidden ground. Then it makes him the sport of temptation and does not give him over till he is fast bound in the chains of eternal death. In its very nature it is deceitful. It is a stranger to all open and honest dealing. Its very element is the region of false appearances and lying promises and fatal snares. When it addresses itself to the unwary youth, it puts on a smiling countenance and makes fair pretensions and takes care to conceal its hideous features, till like a serpent it has entwined him with its deadly folds and rendered his escape impossible. For instance, how common is it for young men to yield to the solicitations of evil companions from the notion that it discovers great independence of character? But what sort of independence, I would ask, is that which cannot command resolution enough to resist a few worthless and wicked companions? What sort of independence is that which had rather put at hazard the entrance of eternity than to brave the sneers of half a dozen vile associates? The truth is that the person who acts this part shows himself the greatest coward that walks the earth. He is afraid to encounter the reproaches of those who censure his high praise. And rather than to do it, he deliberately consigns his character and his soul to destruction. Again, how often do young men become profane from the idea that profaneness marks the gentleman, and that to break out occasionally in the language of cursing gives them a sort of dignity and importance? But let them go out into the street and see in what kind of characters this vice is to be found in its most frightful perfection, and then say whether they wish to share the honor of profaneness with such companions. Let them listen to the poor drunkard who has fallen down in the highway and is just wakened from his beastly slumber, and they will find him muttering an oath, cursing the God that made him, or it may be the hand that is attempting to relieve him. Let them go into the most vulgar circles, where not even decency is tolerated, and there they will find profaneness, vulgarity, and intemperance mingling in the same scene of disgust and riot. And yet they are cheated into the delusion that at least an occasional indulgence in this vice makes them more respectable. They are beguiled, as it were, our first parents by the fatal apple, and think not the danger till it is too late to avert it. Number two. We learn from this subject how dreadful is the character of a corrupter of others. Every wicked man is more or less chargeable with this, whether he particularly intends it or not, because it is impossible for him to live in the world without exerting an influence upon those with whom he associates. And this influence will receive its complexion altogether from his character. But there are men with whom the business of corrupting others is a profession, who deliberately lay their plans for ruining immortal souls, who seize upon the unwary youth like the animal upon his prey, and never leave him till they have accomplished his destruction. I know not that there are any such here. I am willing to believe there are none. But if such a man has been providentially sent to the sanctuary, I cannot feel willing that he should go away without a word of warning. Now, I am not going to expostulate with you in regard to the danger, or cruelty, or guilt of your conduct, but only to direct your thoughts to one event, which will as certainly overtake you as that there is a God in heaven. You are hastening to the judgment, and at the awful bar you will meet every soul that you have helped to destroy, and the blood of each of these souls will be upon your own head. Nay more, your corrupting influence may be propagated from generation to generation, and thousands whom you may have never seen in the flesh may recognize you at the judgment as their destroyer, and the united curses of all these miserable beings may be heaped upon you through the ages of a suffering eternity. If your heart has not absolutely received the dark seal of reprobation, or if all the fountains of feeling have not been congealed by the chilling atmosphere of vice, must not the prospect fill you with horror? Number 3. The subject supplies an important argument to all in favor of a religious life. It is but too common for persons of vicious character to take shelter under the plea that they injure none but themselves, and that whatever the consequence of their conduct may be, they alone must bear it. Never was there a greater mistake. A corrupt example, even where it is not accompanied by a deliberate purpose of corruption, mingles contagion with the whole moral atmosphere in which it operates, and such must ever be its effect, until human nature is subject to a new set of laws. What a powerful motive is here for a life of virtue and piety! You are acting not for yourselves alone, but for the world around you. And when we urge you to a life of religion, we are pleading in behalf of the immortal interests of your fellow men. What an argument also for the most exemplary circumspection on the part of the professed disciples of Christ. You may have even a living principle of religion which will secure your own salvation, and yet for the want of proper vigilance, you may be betrayed into practices which will blast the rising germ of youthful promise, and even cause the darkest shades of vice to settle on some heart which had already begun to yield to the impressions of religion. How tremendous the thought that a friend, by a careless and unedifying example, should be instrumental in destroying his friend for whom he would even have died. How delightful, on the other hand, is the reflection that by yielding your hearts and lives to the purifying influence of the gospel, you may not only save yourselves, but may be preparing to meet some in heaven. It may be the objects of your tenderest affection who will have been conducted thither by the light of your example. Finally, let every young person be deeply impressed with the danger of his situation and avoid the beginning of evil. I cannot suppose that there is a youth before me who has deliberately formed the purpose to resign himself to a vicious habit and to persevere in it till he shall enter eternity. But I have reason to fear that there are those here in whom this fearful result will actually be realized. Those who are venturing into the paths of vice, with the most idle of all notions that they shall retreat early enough to save their souls. Alas, with all your advantages, I fear you have not yet learned the slippery and insidious nature of vice. As well might you think to take the deadly viper into your bosom and render him harmless by flattering words. As well might you drink down the fatal poison and expect to stop its progress in your system when the blood had curdled at your heart, as to think of being the companions of fools and yet not be destroyed. If you enter on a career of vice and make the wicked your chosen companion. Right? Acknowledge that omnipotence may, in his adorable sovereignty, pluck you as a brand out of the burning, but without some special interposition, which you have no right to expect, it is altogether probable that you will be lost forever. Your own safety lies in a cordial, practical, immediate reception of the gospel of Christ. Every other guide will mislead you. This will conduct you safely and certainly to heaven. And now, if such a conclusion would not do violence to all the principles of human calculation, I would fain believe that all of you have resolved to enter immediately and in earnest on a religious life. But probably there are some here who have not even thought of forming such a purpose, and perhaps others who have formed it and whose remembrance it will hereafter exist as a monument of the power of temptation or the treachery of the heart. I confess that an ominous gloom settles upon my mind as I venture forward to explore the paths of these persons through the darkness of futurity. I see them going away from this place unaffected by all which they have heard, and returning to the haunts of sin with as keen a relish as ever. I see them becoming more and more hardened in vice, turning their backs upon religious instruction, and living as if eternity were a dream and the Word of God a fable. At no great distance onward in the path of life, I discover them struggling under the pressure of adversity. I hear them call to the world for assistance, but the world turns a deaf ear to their entreaties. I extend my views yet a little further and see these same persons on the bed of death. I see by the sinking countenance, the fluttering pulse, the faltering accents that their conflict with the destroyer has commenced. I cast an eye around me to see whether any of their former vicious companions are present, to try to sustain them in this awful exigency. But not one of them is to be seen. Theirs was a work of destruction, not of consolation. I see them writhing in agonies unutterable, oppressed and appalled by the prospect of an opening retribution, without a hold in the universe on which to hang a single hope. I hear their lamentations over a misspent life, their cutting reflections upon their miserable associates, their agonizing supplications for a longer space for repentance. And while my eye rests with horror on the frightful impressions that despair has made upon the countenance, I witness the ominous change which tells me that the soul is in eternity. And then amidst all the wellings of parental tenderness which surround me, and while my mind is busy in trying to recollect some word or look which might have been a symptom of repentance, even then from that world where hope never comes that comes to all, I seem to hear echoed in groans of unavailing anguish, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and I am not saved. And is there a youth before me of whose future lot all this may prove to have been a faithful prediction? Especially is there one who has been dedicated to God and had the benefit of a Christian education and parental prayers, and whose experience this complicated wretchedness shall be realized. O Lord God, Thou knowest. Lecture 3. Danger of Evil Instruction. Proverbs 19, verse 27. Cease, my son, to hear the instruction that causes to err from the words of knowledge. The primary element of a good character are good principles. Not that good principles necessarily imply a good character, for experience proves that passion often neutralizes their influence. But a truly good character does necessarily involve good principles. Let a system of false opinions in regard to religion once gain possession of any mind, and what can you expect but that from this bitter fountain will issue streams of corruption and death? Hence it is that those evil men who corrupt and destroy the young are exceedingly apt to assail first their religious principles, not doubting if they can gain a victory here, that they shall be able without difficulty to storm the citadel of the heart. To this end they often make the great truths of religion the subject of conversation, assailing them with sophistry on the one hand and ridicule on the other. They thrust into their handbooks and newspapers to occupy their leisure, which are artfully designed to unhinge their moral and religious principles. And not unfrequently, this malignant agency is exerted in a covert manner, and the youth is brought in contact with these vehicles of death, and has actually begun to extract the poison before he is aware of it. In short, every means of corrupting the principles of the young, which the ingenuity of man can devise, has been and still is employed. And the two, by persons of every rank, from the highest to the lowest in the community. It is in reference to efforts like these that the wise man gives the advice contained in our text. Cease, my son, to hear the instruction that causes to err from the words of knowledge. In the spirit of this direction, I shall endeavor in the present discourse, first, to expose some of the errors of which youth at the present day are in danger, and secondly, urge some considerations to dissuade them from being found in the way of evil instruction. Number 1. I am first to expose some of the errors of which youth at the present day are in danger. The first which I shall notice is that the Bible is not a divine revelation. I am aware that this is by no means a day of triumph for infidelity, and that the man who now openly casts off the authority of revelation does it at the expense of being branded with at least some degree of public disgrace. Still, there are to be found those even at this day, and I fear not a few, who have hardihood enough to pronounce the Bible a forgery, who deliberately set themselves to seal this fountain of consolation against the wretched, this fountain of salvation against the sinner. Unhappily, we live so near the period in which the world was convulsed by what seemed the momentary triumph of infidelity, that infidels of our day find weapons enough for prosecuting their malignant warfare forged at their hands, and yet, as it would seem, for no other purpose than to keep a malignant invention busy, they are from time to time replenishing their armory with other weapons of their own devising. Those to whom I now refer are open in their hostility to the Bible. They breathe out the venom of infidelity wherever they go, and put their books in circulation whenever they have opportunity and glory in their shame. But there are others who lend their aid to the same cause by means a little less direct, but not less effectual. Perhaps they will not tell you that they believe the Bible to be a forgery. Perhaps they will even give a vague assent to its being a divine revelation. But they will tell you, with nearly the same breath, of indifferent passages which have a contradictory meaning, of stories too trifling and of doctrines too absurd to have had such a being as God for their author. And thus, by endeavoring to bring into contempt a part of the Bible, they aim to destroy the authority of the whole. So long as men of this character are scattered through society, who can doubt that young people are in danger of being corrupted by infidelity? Now, my young friends, I will tell you, if you are ever tempted for a moment to give heed to those who would persuade you to renounce your belief in the Bible as a divine revelation, what you must be able to prove before you consistently venture on infidel ground. You must be able to show that the miracles of which the Bible contains a record either were never performed, or if they were, that they do not prove its divine authority. If you take the former side of the alternative and say that these miracles were never performed, you must still admit either they were pretended to be performed or they were not. If they were pretended to be performed, as recorded in Scripture, it behooves you to show how it was that so many competent witnesses, and among them the most malignant enemies, in circumstances the most favorable for detecting imposture, and for several years in succession, should actually have been deceived. If you say that they were not pretended to be performed, then you have to account for the fact that such a record of them as that which the Bible contains should have been made at the very time when the imposture, if it were one, was most open to detection, and that it should have been circulated first among the very persons who have been most interested and most able to detect it, who yet never even pretended to call the facts in question. If you say that the record of these miracles was not made during the age in which they were professedly performed, but that it was palmed upon some succeeding age, then you have to account for the fact that the whole mass of historical testimony fixes the date of this record to nearly the period in which they are alleged to have been performed. And you have this additional difficulty to solve, how a record of facts purporting to have occurred under the observation of the very people to whom the record was first given could have been received by them as a true record, when at the same time no such facts had ever fallen within their knowledge. But if you choose the latter side of the alternative, and say that these miracles were actually wrought, but still do not prove the Bible to be a divine revelation, you have then to show either that the God of truth would give the stamp of his authority to falsehood, or else that these mighty works were performed by the aid of evil spirits, for that they transcended the limits of human power admits of no question. The former of these suppositions, that Jehovah has lent his sanction to falsehood, you will not dare to admit, even in thought. If you admit the latter, and refer the miracles of the Bible to diabolical agency, then you have this great moral phenomenon to explain, how the enemy of all good came to be so heartily and earnestly engaged in the destruction of his own kingdom. For the manifest tendency of all the miracles of the Bible was to promote the cause of righteousness. Here then you perceive at the threshold of infidelity, you have most serious difficulties to encounter, but the half has not been told you. You have farther to account for the fact that this book contains a long chain of prophecies, extending almost from the beginning of the world to the present time and to all future ages, that as a plan of providence has been developed, these prophecies have regularly had their fulfillment in the history of the church and the world, that the most imminent and improbable events have occurred in exact correspondence with predictions which were written ages before their occurrence. If there were no divine wisdom here, whence this marvelous power of lifting the veil that hides futurity? How is it that a worm can tell of things that are to be unless he has been mounting up above the dust and holding communion with omniscience? Who dares be so impious as to say that Jehovah would arrange the system of his providence to meet the conjectures of weak fanaticism or weak imposture? You have, moreover, before you can consistently reject the divine authority of the Bible, to account for the fact that so many different persons, as were concerned in writing it, living in different ages and various states of society, and in circumstances to preclude the possibility of collusion, could have produced a book between whose various parts there is the most perfect, though evidently on their part the most undesigned, harmony. If all the letters of which the Bible is composed were to be separated from each other and thrown promiscuously into the air and should fall to the earth in precisely the order which they originally held, making a regular and complete book, it would not be a greater anomaly in human experience than would be found in the fact that such a book as the Bible is, in respect to the harmony of its parts, should have been made in the circumstances in which it was made, independently of divine inspiration. You have still farther to account for the fact that men living in a rude state of society, and many of them with the most limited advantages for intellectual cultivation, should have produced compositions which in sublimity both of thought and language leave far behind the finest models, whether of ancient or modern times. The most perfect specimens of narrative which the world has seen are found in the Gospels, but what was there in the laborious occupation of fishermen that gave promise of these matchless performances? If you deny that these persons wrote under divine inspiration, whence the mighty difference between their productions and what you could reasonably expect from persons in the same sphere of life, and with much better advantages of education among ourselves? You have also to account for the fact that the Bible presents a higher standard of moral purity than is anywhere else to be found, that all its doctrines and precepts, all its promises and threatenings are worthy of an infinitely holy God. Tell us, if this be imposture, how it has come to pass that wicked men, the enemies of holiness, have produced the holiest book that the world has ever seen. If they could have done this, where was the motive to influence them to it, so long as it was directly opposed to their corrupt views and purposes? If they had desired to do it, would it not still, being conceived in sin, necessarily have borne in a greater or less degree the moral likeness of its authors? And finally, you have to account for the wonderful efficacy with which the Bible has been attended. Compare the combined moral effects which have been produced by all the other books in the world with those which have been produced by the Bible, and the former dwindle to nothing in the comparison. It is the Bible which is the means of accomplishing such wonderful transformations, as we sometimes see of human character, making the proud humble, the vindictive forgiving, the cruel tender-hearted, causing the swearer to reverence the name of God, the drunkard to lay aside his cups, the dishonest man to give back his ill-gotten gains, and the miser to open his coffers to the call of charity. It is the Bible which has shed the light of peace and hope around the path of adversity, which has been a pillow for sickness and a staff for old age, which has caused the voice of rejoicing to rise even from the valley of death. It is the Bible which has demolished altars of cruelty and temples of idolatry, which has illumined the wilderness with the light of civilization, and for savage customs has substituted the soft charities of life, which as it travels round the globe sends abroad a healing influence and leaves a bright track of glory behind it. Whence is it, I ask, that the Bible produces these wonderful effects if it has not God for its author? How is it, if it be the work of man, that it has survived all the efforts which have been made for its destruction, that like the burning bush, it has always been on fire, and yet has never been consumed? Such, my young friends, are some of the difficulties to be encountered before you can, with any show of reason, reject the divine authority of the Scriptures. You must be able to show that the miracles which the Bible records either were never performed, or if they were, that they do not prove it to be of divine revelation, that the prophecies which it contains, notwithstanding their literal and exact accomplishment, were only fortunate conjectures. You must be able to account for the fact that so many writers on such a subject, and in such circumstances, have written with perfect harmony, that men comparatively destitute of intellectual culture have written with such unparalleled sublimity, that men of the most corrupt minds, for the idea of imposture necessarily supposes this, have made a book which breathes the most elevated purity, and finally that this book bearing the signature of heaven upon its title page, and thus affronting Jehovah by a lie, has gone abroad, changing the moral wilderness into a garden, and pouring light and joy into every bosom by which it has been welcomed. Until you are able to account for these and many similar facts, you cannot for a moment consistently place your foot on infidel ground. How then ought you to estimate the cavils of infidelity as lighter than nothing, till you have deliberately and satisfactorily met all the difficulties which have now been suggested?
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, "I have not commanded them," whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.